Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and ever since May, we've been doing a series called Your Anecdotal Census, a People's History of the New York City Area from 2000 to 2010. As the government has conducted its official census headcount, we've gone county by county collecting your stories through just about every county in the New York metro area, all five boroughs, plus the six nearest counties in New York State, six in New Jersey, plus Fairfield County, Connecticut. Today, we wrap up that series, and our 5 months of census coverage, which began in early March, will play some highlights from our anecdotal census shows and take one step further back to look at what we've learned about the big picture of community change in greater New York. For example, from our segment on Bergen County, remember these few seconds with Mike Kelly from the Bergen Record, with Councilman Jason Kim of Palisades Park, the first Korean-American elected official anywhere on the East Coast? Oh, we don't have that clip? Okay, we'll get that clip in a minute. And we conclude this series on the day that the Census Bureau is out with one surprising final number. They finish counting Americans at around $1.5 billion under budget. Of course, the end of the census also means the end of 500,000 temporary jobs. Census worker layoffs were the main reason that jobless figures grew last month, even though the private sector added jobs. During this segment, we will take calls from you former census workers to tell us what you learned during this job. You can start calling now at 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692. Tell us your best story from your census job, or in a larger sense, tell us what you learned doing the census job. 212-433-WNYC. 212-433-9692. Now we have that first best of clip. These few seconds with Mike Kelly, who's the first voice from the Bergen Record, with Councilman Jason Kim of Palisades Park, the first Korean-American elected official anywhere on the East Coast.
Jason is absolutely right. The Korean business community really rescued Palisades Park, because he's right. The main street in Palisades Park was having some hard times economically, and Korean businesses came in there and really turned the place around, yeah.
Right now, 95% of a store owner belongs to the Asian-American on Main Street.
Jason,
and they also give out the very authentic culture to the whole Bergen County.
Before you go, how does the Korean-American population tend to vote? Democrat or Republican or House split?
A little over toward the Democratic side rather than Republican side, I believe, because of the immigration policies.
And has that been pretty consistent over the last 10 years, or has that changed?
12 years, yeah, it has been very consistent.
Jason Kim and Mike Kelly in our Bergen County Anecdotal Census segment from back in May. And we will have several guests along the way to wrap the series up as your calls come in. If you were a census worker, what was the most interesting day on the job for you as a census taker? And what are some of the larger lessons you learned, if you want to go in that direction? 212-433-9692. First, the intrepid New York Times reporter who has covered census data and population change for many years, Sam Roberts. You may also see him as host of New York Times Close Up on New York One. His latest book is America's Mayor, about former New York Mayor John Lindsay, in conjunction with the exhibit on the Lindsay years, now showing at the Museum of the City of New York through October 3rd. Hey, Sam, thanks for doing this. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you, Brian, and congratulations on your series. I think it's really been informative and filled in a lot of people on what the census is really all about and what it means.
Thanks so much, and that actually means a lot to me coming from you. And we'll start with the topic of your article in the paper today. The census taking was completed at 22% under budget. That's $1.5 billion less than allotted. Who ever heard of a government program coming in under budget?
Well, it is unusual. There are a couple of reasons for it. One is there was no giant epidemic like swine flu that deterred census takers and homeowners. There was no flooding or hurricane or natural disaster like that that interfered. One of the main reasons, though, is that the response rate, the mail response rate, rate was about 72%, which may not look that great and was only about the same as it was in 2000, even though the census spent a lot more money. But the response rate to most surveys, public and private, has been going down. So the Census Bureau was pretty pleased with this. One of the concerns that Census Director Robert Groves just voiced this today is that in the follow-up interviews, knocking on the doors of 47 million homes in the United States, in about one out of five in those, going as many as six times, the census workers could not find anyone. And so they did what ultimately is called proxy count or imputation even. They went to neighbors and they went to building managers to find out who actually lives there. And, you know, that calls into question the total accuracy of the census, that many people were unable to be interviewed directly.
Interesting. And let's hear from one of those door-to-door census takers, Brenda in Morris County. Hi, Brenda. You're on WNYC.
Hi.
So?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes. So you did it. What was your beat? Did you go to door-to-door somewhere?
I did. I went. My biggest thing was that the nicer the house, and there's a lot of really nice homes in Morris County, and generally speaking, the nicer the house, the nastier the people.
No.
And I had people, like, jump down my throat about Obama this, and why does they want to know, and who's asking, and I was like, hey, this is my job.
And did you get a decent response rate from those people?
Well, I had the same problem as you were just describing. I kept going back and going back and going back, and it was like, you know, I kept leaving a notice saying, you know, you can call me. I only live around the corner. And no one ever, no, I won't say never called. But I would say maybe 30% of the people did ultimately call me. And sometimes we did it over the phone. And that was okay, too. But
Did you ever have to resort to imputation, that is, finding out about the people from the neighbors?
Yes, I did. And it worked very well, you know, especially when it was like a house that had maybe four apartments in it. And they knew each other very well.
Mm-hmm.
And that worked. It worked out fine.
Sam Roberts, anything you want to ask Brenda?
Well, I'd like to know roughly in how many cases that happened, Brenda. Of all the enumerations you did, in how many cases did you have to rely on a neighbor or a building manager or someone like that?
I would say maybe 30% of the time.
That's a lot.
That's just about the national average.
Yeah.
The national average was about 22.
That's
amazing.
Interesting. Brenda, thank you very much. Are you surprised, Sam, that this took place in a high-income area like Morris County?
Well, not necessarily. I mean, one of the things that the Census Bureau has found is that more and more people are working. They are home less often. They have less time to spare. But generally, you're absolutely right that one of the indications of hard-to-count areas is a lower-income area, an area of more immigrants, an area of more people who are poor, more people in rental housing. Those are the areas specifically classified as harder to count, not a more well-to-do area.
Traditionally. Your article says some of the savings came because census takers were better educated than in past years, leading to more efficient door-to-door visits. What's the connection there?
Well, better educated, you know, that's a plus and a minus. They were better educated because nowadays during the recession, they're out of work. So the census had a more qualified pool, arguably, to hire from, better educated, more experienced, and therefore, you know, they were able to do better interviews, take the time, had probably a higher rate, arguably, of literacy. They could find addresses better. They could deal with people better. And that helped increase the response rate as they were going door to door.
So again, you census takers with doctorates or whoever you are, call in with your best story from a day on the job as a census worker or, in a larger sense, anything you learn. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. As we wrap up our 5 months of census coverage today, Kevin in Yonkers, hi.
Hi. I found during the census that there was a real distrust of the confidentiality of this census material. And I think with the situation in Arizona coinciding with the first phase of the census, it didn't really help. And I don't think the Census Bureau did a good job of getting that information out, that this is confidential. We're only interested in The count, head count, the demographic information is only going to be used for whatever purposes.
So how did you try to counter that suspicion once it came down to your level?
Well, I mean, all you can basically do, I mean, when you approach the people, you're giving them a confidentiality agreement in the paperwork that you present to each person. But you really can't get around the fact, and I would just say, well, the census really didn't get that information out to the public very well, but there are agreements that we have to sign, and we can go to prison if we give up any of your information. So nobody from the census is going to really be willing to give up any of your information.
Was your beat in Yonkers?
Yes.
And did you have the same sort of 30% resistance rate that our caller from Morris County did?
About a third. Plus, I had to do both phases of the census, where you basically have to go back after the first phase was done and go to all the vacant and deleted properties, which a lot of those properties, people just wouldn't open up their door, and you have to end up going to a neighbor or finding a management company, and sometimes that was even difficult.
Kevin, thank you so much for your call.
Okay.
And Sam Roberts, New York Times reporter, is with us. He's covered the census for many years. Sam, in this anecdotal census series, we've had a web page for every county, as you know, and I guess I would identify three big trends that I think we saw people posting stories about. Gentrification all over New York City, with the good and the bad that that brings. Increasing traffic and ugly McMansions in the suburbs, both those two things. More density with increasing traffic, and a lot of resentment over the conversion of traditional-sized homes to what they consider ugly McMansions in the suburbs. Of course, a lot of those people had to be living in those McMansions. But, you know, the third thing is pure demographics, with increases in diversity everywhere in greater New York, as we heard about the regeneration of Palisades Park with Korean Americans in the clip that we played earlier. Anything you would add to that list as top line trends in our area over the last 10 years?
Well, I think those capture it very well. The diversity, and also we've talked about this before, something that resembles, at least temporarily, a racial equilibrium. The share of non-Hispanic whites in the city has been shrinking since at least the 1940s, even earlier than that. And now, in this decade, it appears, we don't have the complete results yet, that that seems to have stabilized. In fact, so-called white flight seems to have ended. That might be a result of the recession. It might be that retirees aren't able to sell their homes and leave the city like they would be doing before, that people aren't leaving to take jobs anywhere else. At the same time, you see greater diversity within the city and within the metropolitan area. In Sunset Park, Brooklyn, for example, the proportion of people who don't speak English at home went down by more than 17%. That's gentrification in what was previously a heavily Hispanic and Asian area. At the same time, parts of Staten Island, particularly the southern part, you see the share who don't speak English going up 26% because of an influx of Chinese and Spanish speakers. So what you're seeing is, instead of, you know, pockets, very distinct pockets of population, you're seeing a much more diverse city and a much more diverse metropolitan area across the board.
We'll continue in a minute with our anecdotal census finale. Sam Roberts, Angelo Falcone will join us too. We'll play some best of clips, and we'll take more calls from census workers now that this job has completed. And sorry to say, many of you are in our audience today because you're now unemployed again. Sorry about that. But we want to know, what was the most interesting day on the job for you as a census worker, and perhaps what were some of the bigger lessons that you learned? 212-433-WNYC. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. We're doing our anecdotal census finale. Sam Roberts from the New York Times is here for another few minutes. And also joining us now is Angelo Falcone, president and founder of the National Institute for Latino Policy and chair of the Census Bureau's Hispanic Advisory Committee. Hey, Angelo, welcome back to WNYC.
Nice to be here.
And we'll get back to your calls from you now laid-off census workers in a minute. But we talked so much in the spring, Angelo, about the various hard-to-count populations in the New York area. And I think you were coming up in the elevator when our census taker caller from Morris County, New Jersey, told us that the rich could be hard to count, too, because they were resistant to the government.
Yeah.
But typically, traditionally, immigrants, single people, renters as opposed to owners, a lot of hard-to-count categories in the New York City population. So how did New York do at getting counted, and how precisely can we know at this point?
Well, at this point, it's really going to be very hard to tell. The Census Bureau has a what they call a coverage measurement program, where they're going to be doing a post-enumeration survey, and they're going to do some demographic mumbo-jumbo and stuff down the road, and then come up with some estimates to see how much off the census was in looking at various groups. We're probably going to have to wait like for a year for that kind of information to get to us. So right now, everything is quote-unquote anecdotal in terms of, whether it was accurate or not. A lot of, in the news, a lot of horror stories about people maybe, filling out census forms on their own and all sorts of scandals and all that kind of stuff going on. So it's really hard to tell.
I thought you were involved with the real census, and we were doing the anecdotal census. And it's all anecdotal.
It's all. It really is at this point.
Amy in Hoboken. You were a census taker, Amy?
Yes, I was.
And?
Well, I think I was supposed to originally be enumerating in Hoboken, but there was a mix-up. Instead, I wound up going to Union City, which at first I was nervous about because I don't speak Spanish. However, I found it would be quite an experience, this idea that Union City is a very densely populated area is hard to imagine until you actually go up there and enumerate. So it was a wonderful experience. Most of the people were quite helpful, actually.
And you learned about density. You were saying you realized how densely people are living?
Yes, as a matter of fact, oddly enough, through talking to the children on the street, because they would tell me, oh, well, there's seven people in that place, and you'd look and it looks like a two-room apartment, and it would be like, wow, this is really, there's a lot of people living up here.
That was an eye-opener for you.
Yeah, and also the diversity of nationalities as well.
Certainly in Union City, that's for sure. Amy,
yeah.
Thank you very much. So there's kind of crossing cultural lines education for Amy. Maybe you would have known better about Union City.
Well, one of the challenges with the census this time was that issue of people, doubling up, a lot of people here illegally. You have a lot of illegal apartments. So it's a real challenges in terms of these very, very now very complex households. How do you count them? And in fact, to the point where it's really raising challenges about whether the Census Bureau should be using the household as a unit of analysis, because it's changed so much. Does it make sense to talk about the traditional household anymore?
As opposed to what?
As opposed to something else. As opposed to something that's more dense. So those are the kinds of discussions that I think are going to be coming out of this this experience.
All right. Angela Falcone and Sam Roberts, I want to get your reaction to this clip from earlier in our anecdotal census series. We had a great call in one day for Dominicans living in Washington Heights or those who had grown up and left. And so let me replay a clip. This is from May. This is from a caller, Phalo from Washington Heights.
This neighborhood has definitely changed. You have one side of the neighborhood, very young, very expensive. I see a lot of some of these buildings are being remodeled to accommodate a more upper high rent. And then you have another.
That's over in the extreme western part of the area, right? Hudson Heights, along the Hudson River, et cetera, right?
Not necessarily so. You see it on 168, you see it on 190s, you see it 207, 214. It's just that a lot of people from downtown are coming up because it's very expensive to live downtown.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have another side of this neighborhood that's becoming more poor. It's very hard for many Dominican immigrants now to find a job that pays a living wage. And it's very hard to be living up here.
Do you think it's harder than it was 10 years ago, Phalo?
Absolutely. It is getting more and more. You have a lot of other poor Hispanics moving in, mostly from Mexico. And then you have a lot of people coming in which are more desperate. And the small businesses, years ago, you would see $10, $12 an hour. You do not see that anymore.
And so what are people doing to get by in these more desperate circumstances?
You have people here moving away to places like Allentown. You have people moving away to places like in the Carolinas. And you have people going back to the Dominican Republic.
And there's the churn, Angelo Falcone. And again, that clip, Fela from Washington Heights was the caller in our anecdotal census series in May. Angelo Falcone is with us from the Census Hispanic Advisory Committee and the National Institute for Latino Policy, and Sam Roberts covering the census for the New York Times. There's part of the churn and
sure.
the gentrification
sure.
Clashing with people living in poor circumstances being forced out.
Well, Sam broke that story about how the Manhattan now, the majority of the population in Manhattan has become white.
Yeah.
So those are the kinds of dramatic changes that you're seeing. And interesting with the Washington Heights community, the Dominican community, is that now probably the largest concentration of Dominicans is now not Washington Heights, but in the Bronx. So there is that movement not only to Allentown, these places, but also to the Bronx.
Sam?
And what you're seeing also, Brian, is a bifurcated decade. You're seeing people having much more success in the earlier part of the decade than the recession hitting and it becoming a lot harder for people across the board, but especially for poorer people. And nowhere do you see the gentrification more obvious than in Harlem, where since the beginning of the decade, the number of white people living there more than tripled, driving up the median household income. But almost all of that rise was attributable to white newcomers, not to blacks who were already living there.
And Sam, as you may have seen, Susan Dominus has a fascinating column in the Times today about the culture clash that gentrification has brought to even a parenting website in Harlem, where, you know, they clashed over really over class issues.
That's right. And they really are, I mean, maybe this is a slightly hopeful sign, they really are more class issues, I think, than race issues.
And you've written about census numbers showing that Harlem in particular became one-third white
yep.
in the past decade, one-third.
Yeah, well, Congressman Rangel's in the news these days. His district is 45% Latino. It's about 25% black and 25%, something like 25% around there white. It's not the image people have.
Well, it's also that it's a very long district. It's
yeah.
an extreme West Side district that starts on the Upper West Side. You know, I used to live on the Upper West Side. And he was my congressman.
Mm-hmm.
Now I live in Inwood, north of Washington Heights in Harlem, and he's still my congressman.
Yeah. Yeah.
And if you look at Central Harlem, Brian, Central Harlem itself, very narrowly defined, is barely majority black.
Right.
And Sam Roberts, we're going to let you go. Any last thought on any of this?
No, just congratulations again on your series. I think it added a lot to all your listeners.
Definitely. Thanks so much. Sam Roberts from the New York Times covering the census. And his book, America's Mayor, about John Lindsay, a companion book to the exhibit about the Lindsay years currently at the Museum of the City of New York. And we continue with Angelo Falcone. Angelo, I was mentioning to Sam before that from the listeners' posts on our anecdotal census pages in general, we saw, I think, three big trends that people were writing about. Gentrification, as we just discussed. Pure demographic change with increases in diversity everywhere in greater New York. And increasing traffic and ugly McMansions in the suburbs. Anything you would add to that list as top-line trends in our area over the last 10 years?
Well, just that what we're seeing is a reality in New York and around the country that's getting much more complex. The same kind of general trends. I mean, we still have an amazing amount of segregation in the city, but it's become a more kind of what I call detailed segregation. We just talked about Harlem. You know, we always identify Harlem as a black neighborhood, but it's getting much more complex so that you may have on the surface what appears to be a more diverse neighborhood, but you find that the interaction within that neighborhood between, let's say, blacks, Latinos, and whites is not what you would think it. There isn't as much. There are conflicts. And that segregation gets more detailed, more complicated, more complex, and we don't know what it means politically. For example, right now the big issue is redistricting. Now everybody's getting ready for this redistricting thing. That's really based geographically, and so how now do you develop districts that really meet these community of interest kind of criteria of people that have things in common that you would want in the same kind of districts, whether it's the Congress or the city council? So that's going to be really interesting to watch.
And related to that, here's another clip. clip as we review some fascinating moments from the series that shows demographic change in a different kind of complex way within a black church. Again, from earlier in our anecdotal census series, the guest is Mamie Bridgeforth, pastor of a historically African-American church in Newark.
Well, the change that I see is that historically the black churches in Newark were mainly African-American, but there's been a tremendous growth of African of churches of people of African descent. By that I mean we have a very large Caribbean population that has moved into the city of Newark, and you also have a very large African population from the continent.
Is the role of the church in the community, even in political life, the same for the immigrant black churches as it was for the African American church in America?
Now, you know, it's very interesting that you ask that question because I hesitate to say that it is not. However, what I will say is the social activism and the social theology that has been a very part of the African American experience is not necessarily manifested in our immigrant population churches.
Why not?
I think it has to do with the different cultural experience. It's simply that, you know, the level of cultural stratification that the African-American experienced here in the United States, many of them did not experience in the countries they come from.
Newark pastor Mamie Bridgeforth in our anecdotal census series. Angelo Falcone, any reaction to that clip?
Well, you see it, for example, in the Latino community, in the Catholic Church. You see all these stories about these churches that were predominantly Puerto Rican, and all of a sudden you have Mexicans who are basically taking over the services, and all of a sudden it's the Guadalupe, you know, imagery versus the Puerto. So you see these kind of conflicts occurring at, again, this level that you never saw before, and again, different traditions within the, say, the Catholic Church. So that you see that replicated in the African American community, in the Asian community, all over the place, and again, it's taking us to places where we never would have thought of thinking that we would be going. And so you have this distinction with all the immigration of what people call the native minorities, you know, blacks and Latinos have been here, Puerto Ricans and African Americans, and then you have now Africans coming in and Haitians. And so that mix is something that's been here for quite a while. But it's reached a level now where, it's getting very, very interesting in terms of we're not being clear exactly where this is going and how that's going to shape ethnic identities, racial identities, just the very identity of the city.
It's our anecdotal census finale, and we're still taking calls from you now, laid-off census workers, to tell us about your most interesting day on the job, your best story from your census job, or in a larger sense, anything that you've learned. Risa in Dutchess County, you're on WNYC. Hi, Risa.
You.
Good. You have a story?
Yes. I guess I'm just a little worried about the actual quality control of the census because I went to enumerate a house. A woman was there. She lived in her house in New York, which was her permanent residence, but she had actually done the census in her four other residences, California, Florida, Vermont, and Maine. She'd actually filled out a form at each of these residences by an enumerator. And she told them that she actually lived in New York, and she lived in New York on April 1st, but they didn't care. They went and took the information from her.
She's making up for all the undercount, Angelo.
I guess so, but I think that's actually problematic. I don't know how they account for the margin of error for that. You know, it's probably not a large percentage of people, but I did have a number of people who did fill out the form a number of times, and mostly where I live, there are second homes, so there are people who have, you know, they're snowbirds. They live in Florida or they live in Arizona, something like that. But they are counted.
And they spend the summer in Dutchess County.
That's right.
Right.
That's
well, I think one of the things is the Census Bureau has protocols for this. I mean, if you notice, you know, your census forms had barcodes. And also all that information now in terms of it goes through these data processing centers that are supposed to pick up these duplicates. But again, it's not perfect. So there will be overcounts, definitely. But that's a big challenge. That is the technology is supposed to be able to catch all of this stuff. So we should get to a point at some point where you should be able to fill out a form no matter where you are yourself. And the technology should be able to pick up those kind of duplicates. But again, we're going to have to wait and see. We're going to have to see as they do these post post-enumeration surveys to see how much of an overcount there was, how many undercounts by different groups. But, yeah, that definitely is a challenge.
Risa, thank you for your call. Susan in Croton-on-Hudson has a story. Hi, Susan.
Hi, good morning. I was met at the door by an older gentleman who didn't have a stitch of clothing on, and I kind of was taken aback, and he said, "Girlie, if you're going to ask me about my plumbing, I'm going to show you my plumbing."
And what did you do?
I kind of just took a breath and turned my head, and I said, "Okay, I guess I'll have my supervisor take this one," and just got in the car and checked that one off as a revisit. And not by me.
Thank you very much for your call. All right, we're doing our anecdotal census finale, stories of naked men answering the doors and all, with Angela Falcone, president and founder of the National Institute for Latino Policy and chair of the Census Bureau's Hispanic Advisory Committee. And also joining us now is Andrew Beveridge, population expert at Queens College and the CUNY Graduate Center, and creator of a great demographics website called socialexplorer.com. Hi, Andrew. Welcome back to WNYC.
Well, thank you, Brian. I'm delighted to be here.
Have you been listening to Angelo and Sam Roberts before him? Anything you want to jump in on from what you've already heard?
Well, I think the only thing that I would mention, and I think Angelo sort of hit it, and hello, Angelo, it's nice to talk to you, is the idea of the overcount. It's very well known that upscale whites are overcounted, and one of the reasons is the thing that was discussed by Dutchess County. They have multiple homes, and they fill it out multiple times.
Now, you know the relationship between New York City and its suburbs pretty well. So here is another clip from our anecdotal census series. This one shows the face of the recession for the wealthiest among us. The caller is Tricia in Greenwich.
My big change is the real estate. It's unbelievable in Greenwich, and the prices have dropped so wildly.
How much?
They're still falling. So I'll give you an idea. About 2 years ago, 3 years ago, houses in my mother's neighborhood were going for around $6 million. They've dropped to about 2.8.
That is a two-thirds drop at the highest end. Are there a lot of foreclosures that you're seeing?
In that same neighborhood, there are two, possibly three. And these are huge houses that started at almost $8 million. And I'll tell you, this is not an $8 million neighborhood by anybody's account. It might be in the high end of the market. Maybe it was a $4 or $5 million neighborhood.
These are staggering figures to most of our listeners.
It's a staggering number to me.
What happens to a very affluent family that gets foreclosed upon?
I think they move to Florida.
Tricia in Greenwich, calling our anecdotal census series a few months ago, and you may have noticed I did the math wrong. I actually heard her wrong when she said it went down from 6 million to 2.8. I thought she said 6 million to 2 million. That would have been a two-thirds drop. But still, Andrew Beveridge, I mean, that is an anecdotal, as the title says. It's not scientific real estate analysis, so I don't want to say for sure that values are down by millions. But your reaction to that clip?
No, I think values are down, and I think particularly a place like Greenwich, which is fueled by the hedge fund and financial sector, probably has experienced more of a drop than many places. I mean, one of the reasons I think that New York real estate has been relatively, I mean, it's dropped, I'm not saying that, but, mm-hmm. California's dropped 60%.
Yeah.
The reason it hasn't dropped as much in New York is, there's not that much new construction compared to a place like California or Las Vegas or Arizona. And then secondly, in New York City, there's a lot of rentals, and though, of course, we have had the foreclosure, I don't know if it's a foreclosure, you had a Stuyvesant town and one up in several up in Harlem. But I think the other thing is that they just, you know, the co-ops, there's extra screening for financial background. But in places like Greenwich, there was a big run-up. There was a huge amount of spec construction, and those things do drop. I mean, some of the condos are now called nondos. That is to say, they're renting them. Mm. There are people trying to get out of condo agreements, and that's probably the closest we've come in New York to what's happened in what is often called the sand states.
Still taking calls from you now laid-off census workers as well to tell us your most interesting day on the job or any larger observation now that you're perhaps done with this. Paul in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Brian. How you doing?
Good.
Yeah, I'm actually not officially laid off as of yet. I've been continued on to the vacate and delete section, which is supposed to end this afternoon. But
what does that mean, vacate and delete? Sounds very final and...
Well, the addresses that were marked by enumerators originally as either being vacant or non-existent have to be revisited to confirm. I assume it's quality control, the assumption that enumerators might be giving up on addresses and just marking them as empty or non-existent.
Uh-huh.
But, I mean, I would say that actually... But that said, my experience, my background, I'm one of the, I suppose, more educated census workers who took this as a result of a recession, is in market research. And I would say I do have some concerns about the overall quality of the data. However, I would not put that at the enumerator or crew leader level. I think people have been incredibly earnest and worked very, very hard. But at the management level, at the FOS level, as it's called, the sectional leaders, I think there's been an incredible amount of graft and dishonesty. I mean, incredible, you know, hour bilking. That we've heard plenty of rumors of forged forms. They've been unable to get us new EQs in a timely manner and have as a result, spit out forms of already visited homes. I mean, I've personally been to homes 3-4 times. Well, or I've made the 3rd-4 visit. They've told me other enumerators had visited.
And in other words, they when you don't mean you went and you counted this home again. You mean these were attempts to count a home, and even after you weren't able to, they put it down as something?
No, actually, I didn't count them again, and presumably the second, third visit. But they were visited and counted, but... When the form was turned in up at the higher level of bureaucracy for us, either it wasn't counted there or it was counted and yet a new blank form was still generated for that address and we were sent back.
So is
and
that,
individuals refused to be interviewed a second and third, fourth time.
So is that ineptitude or is that, as you suggested before, graft? And if you think there was graft, what kind of graft?
Well, it's extent ineptitude. I'm not entirely, I mean, I'm a temporary census worker, so I'm obviously not fully aware of the hiring process, but it appears that they weren't particularly careful in who got supervisory positions and who didn't. On the graph level, it's my understanding, and again, this is hearsay, I will admit, that there was a bonus system in place for completing an assigned area quickly. I guess accuracy wasn't as important as speed.
So at least perverse incentives. And Paul, I'm going to leave it there because we're running out of time. Angelo Falcone from the Census Hispanic Advisory Committee. You were raising your eyebrows at some of that.
Yeah, well, you know, I'm a volunteer with Census. I'm not an employee. But one of the things that I notice is right now we're getting a lot of stories about, you know, how the sausage is being made and all the ugliness involved. It's a big bureaucracy. I think sometimes what we have to understand is imagine having to organize over 500,000 temporary workers once every 10 years, having to set up a whole apparatus bureaucracy to do this. Obviously, there are going to be all sorts of problems. And also, there are all these perverse incentives that come out of these bureaucracies that just don't make any sense. There are things like they will follow up. They'll have follow-up interviews just to double-check. And a lot of people at the homes are saying, what the heck? I already filled out the thing. What are you doing this again? And it creates all sorts of bad feelings. So there are a lot of things that we're seeing now, cases that get blown up in the media about people who have forged the forms and those types of things. But when you look at the massiveness of the enterprise, this what they call the largest peacetime mobilization of the federal government, and that fact that it happens once every 10 years. Imagine my memory is terrible after like 6 months, 10 years trying to figure out how to reorganize this stuff. There are going to be all sorts of problems. So as I watch this, I've become much more sympathetic to the problems, and it isn't perfect, certainly, by any means, but
And Andrew
Beveridge. I'd like to make a quick point about this. I think, you know, there's been an overdoing of this problems because you have to realize that the only people they visit are people that didn't send the form in. And the vast bulk of those, probably like 90%, were low-hanging fruit. That is, people would get to the door and they'd say, "Oh yeah, I forgot to fill it out. I'll fill it out. And, you know, we can fill it out right now." So what you're talking about are the small errors, you know, of the, you know, 1 or 2%. And it's very unclear to me whether this is going to have that much effect on the census quality. And as Angelo, I think, mentioned, there is a post-enumeration survey, so we'll be able to tell. So I'm actually, there was a story this morning, I think, during your report, that they saved $1.8 billion because so many people turned the form back in. So I think you have to look at the whole process, not just at the very, very end.
Andrew, we have 30 seconds left, and you'll get the last word. Our census on this show has been anecdotal. Your demography is social science. What are the biggest changes in this decade that you think are important to take away from all this? City, suburbs, whatever.
I think the two big things are the increasing diversity of the suburbs and the offsetting end of white flight and probably the recapturing of blacks and some well-off people into the – recapturing whites and some other well-off people into the cities.
Thanks, Andrew Beveridge, Queens College and CUNY demographer, columnist with Gotham Gazette, and founder of the website socialexplorer.com. And thanks, Angelo Falcone from the Institute for Latino Policy and an advisor on Hispanic affairs to the census as a volunteer, he points out. Thank you both very much.
Thank you, Brian.
And that concludes our series, Your Anecdotal Census. You can still see and still add to the page we have for each county in our listening area at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. And coming up next, in reaction to the flight attendant who grabbed two beers and deployed the emergency slide to quit his job in disgust, what's the best way you've ever quit a job or had someone quit on you? We'll take your phone calls, 212-433-WNYC.